Do your knees make you feel older than you are? You're out here trying to have a hot girl summer at 35. You're on dating apps. You're saying yes to spontaneous trips. Maybe you're rediscovering your flexibility. And your knees are like, actually, we'd like to quit. The IncrediWear Infrared Knee Sleeve uses fabric tech designed to increase blood flow and help reduce pain and speed recovery, so your knees can actually keep up with your life. It's like giving your body the support it already wants while it heals, just without all the extra pain and drama. Wear it to the gym. Wear it on a date. Wear it while you're doing things I cannot say on this podcast. It's comfortable, breathable, and works 24/7. Go to freesocks.com and grab the IncrediWear Knee Sleeve and a free pair of socks with purchase. That's freesox.com. Because if something's gonna give out, let it be him, not your knees.
I've been telling everybody that I give them any shade, but every time I do, my family thinks I'm crazy. The hollow earth, UFOs, aliens, and painting. Throw it in the water, this red sky is daily. When I talk about these things, they think I'm crazy. There's no escaping anymore, the evil that we're facing. Illuminati mind control, they're sacrificing babies. The end of days, but anyways, my family thinks I'm crazy.
So I made three predictions about the world 2 years ago. The first prediction is that Trump would win the November election in 2024, and that's turned out to be correct. Second prediction is that Trump would attack Iran. Trump would start a war against Iran, and that's turned out to be correct as well. And my third prediction is that the United States will lose this war, and that will reshape the global order. It will destroy the American empire. Okay, so those are my three predictions. And Breaking Points, you know, Sagar and Crystal brought me on and we talked for like 15 minutes and they asked me like, you know, do you still stand by your third prediction that America will lose this war? I said, yes, I think America will lose this war because I think that it's asymmetrical warfare and Iran can inflict much more economic damage on America than America would like to admit, that Iran can just draw this out for the longest time, and then America will have to eventually send in ground troops, and then these ground troops will be destroyed because it's a mountain jungle. It's like Vietnam basically. Okay, so that's my understanding of the issue.
You just heard today's guest, host of Predictive History on YouTube channel, who joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this conversation with Professor Zhang. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. And joining us today on the show for the first time is the man behind Predictive History. That's right, Professor Zhang joins us on the show. Professor, it's a pleasure to have you here with me on the show. And I'm very curious how this all began for you. You're over there teaching a class, teaching on a whiteboard, and really immersive, engaging lectures that cover a very wide range of topics that all fit together. So I'm impressed and very grateful that you're putting out the work that you do. So tell us a little bit about how this all started for you.
Yeah, so the first thing about me that's very important is that I am a deeply curious person. Like, I love learning. I'm very inquisitive. I keep on reflecting about the state of the world. And I've been doing that ever since I was young. I was a very avid reader, and I was a very avid reader of science fiction and comic books, especially X-Men. And, you know, these are vast universes that force you to think about different aspects of what it means to be human, especially Isaac Asimov. you know, his Foundation series, his Robot series, his Empire series. He just created this incredibly vast universe that incorporated so many interesting facets of humanity, including, you know, anthropology, psychology, sociology. And so I've always been a very wide-ranging thinker. And I went to Yale. And at Yale, I really did well the first, you know, couple of years because Yale had such a plethora of interesting courses. But you know, towards the end, I was struggling because I really didn't know what to do with my life. The default option was to go to law school, which, and I took the LSATs, and I did very well on the LSATs, and that was my default option to go to law school. And I did apply to Yale Law School, Columbia Law School, just, you know, the usual suspects. And I got waitlisted at Yale, which is a polite way of saying no, because I was a Yale undergraduate, and so you don't really say no to Yale undergraduates if you're Yale Law School, even though you're not really qualified. I mean, the reality was that, and I talked to lawyer friends about this, I wasn't interested in being a lawyer. I was interested in going to law school because that was a prestigious thing to do. But did I really want power? Did I really want to be successful? Did I really want to accrue wealth for myself? And from the application, they can test for that, right? These admissions officers, these Yale professors, they're CIA, the secret society. They know exactly your motivation and your psychology. And they recognize that, you know what? You know, I'm a curious person, but I'm not that ambitious. You know, I'm not driven to political power. That's not the sort of person I am. I'm just a really naturally romantic, curious person. I like to ask questions. I like to debate. And so I was rejected from law school, and that was fine. I didn't care. And I was an alienated person at Yale. I didn't have any friends. My professors thought very highly of me because, you know, I was a very inquisitive person. But I didn't really have that many friends because, as you can imagine, Yale is a place where the children of the elite go, and they have a plan in place. And if you're useful to them, then you become part of the plan. If you're not useful to them, then they just ignore you. You know, they were very polite, they were very charming, but you know, they I didn't make any friends at Yale. I was very alienated. I was very marginalized. I didn't fit into the milieu of Yale. So going to Yale was actually a mistake on my part. But that made me very lonely. That sort of traumatized me psychologically. And so I wanted to find a place where I could fit in. So I decided to go to China, Beijing, where China is where I was born, but I left when I was 6 years old. So I didn't really have any recollections of the country. And I really didn't speak the language, but I went to Beijing. I learned the language. I taught for a couple of years. I became a freelance journalist writing for, you know, the Chronicle of Higher Education. I did a PBS documentary. And then, I was arrested when I was working on the PBS documentary, because, you know, it was a WTO entry and there were worker strikes and they thought I was a spy. They didn't charge me, but they deported me. And they told me, listen, we don't have enough evidence to charge you with spying, but we have to kick you out because that's just a procedure and protocol, but you can come back anytime. So after that, my life started to spiral because I couldn't do journalism anymore. And I became depressed, and I played a lot of StarCraft. I was playing StarCraft from 6 p.m. until 6 a.m., like every single day for 2 years in my parents' basement. And I felt safe. I felt comfortable playing StarCraft. And I was a very happy person playing StarCraft. But as you can imagine, my parents were not very happy about this. So they kicked me out. And so I went back to China and I loafed around. And then I got a job working at the United Nations in Afghanistan because they're desperate for people. And I did that for 6 months. And that was my first exposure actually to the American Empire overseas. And that was a rude awakening because I felt China was corrupt. But you know, if you actually go to Afghanistan, you see the American Empire at work. You see the NGO community, you see the United Nations. You're like, wow, these people are beyond corrupt, man. Because the things I was seeing, the things I was hearing, you know, like the American military was supporting these Afghan warlords who were raping young boys. They were smuggling relics historical relics from Afghanistan. They were protecting the opium trade, you know, to so that the Sackler family could profit. But like that just woke me up about the true state of the world. And so, after 6 months, the United Nations and I mutually decided to depart because it was not getting along. I was too critical. I was too opinionated. And everyone just wanted to relax, enjoy the seafood buffet every Sunday at the five-star hotel, the only five-star hotel in Kabul, and just, build up for the retirement. They made so much money in Afghanistan. I mean, I saw people just walking away with lots and lots of cash. Like, I think the average salary in Afghanistan for just an average expat was about $1 million U.S., tax-free, by the way. So it was just a giant scam. And that really, depressed me, made me more cynical. Fast forward, a few years, and now China is getting wealthier. And a lot of Chinese want to go overseas to study, especially in the States. And I'm a Yale graduate, so I was hired to help these kids apply for study overseas. But I didn't really want to just write their recommendation letters. I just didn't want to write their essays. I want to actually educate them. So I started to teach them the great books and teach them how to think critically. And I've been doing that for a very long time with some minor successes, but mostly it's been a failure. And then I started to have a family. I met the love of my life, my wife, and she's really an angel. She's really changed my life for the better. My life has been one trauma after another, one depression after another, but meeting my wife was completely worth it because I felt as though, there is a God. He is looking after me, and he's built this path of hardship, of trauma, of agony, just so that one day I could meet my wife and I would appreciate my wife for who she is and treat her right. So we have three children. We have three young children now. And I think a lot about how to make sure they have a good future. And then COVID happened, okay? COVID happened, and that was a shock. And before that, Donald Trump won the presidency in 2016, and that was a shock. That traumatized me as well because, when you go to Yale, you're taught that doesn't happen, man, okay? The world is a logical place. It's meritocratic. The people in charge know what they're doing. Just trust them, okay? That's what you're taught at Yale. And then Donald Trump got elected, and, that just traumatized me. And I had TDS for the longest time because I hated this guy. This guy couldn't speak proper English. He was appealing to the worst emotions in people. He's sort of the guy that, when you go to Yale, you're taught that should be at the bottom. He's complete white trash, right? But he won. And so that traumatized me. And then in 2020, I was following the Democratic primary very closely because I wanted Trump to lose. I was convinced Trump was the new Hitler. And I really was really convinced that the Democrats would do everything in their power to make sure that he would lose. And I felt like the best path forward was to pick Bernie Sanders. I felt that if Bernie Sanders was a nominee, then the Democrats could beat Trump easily in the election. And the worst candidate that they could pick was Joe Biden because he was out of touch. He's too old and he is too closely tied with Obama. I felt that Trump won because a lot of American people felt that they were betrayed by Obama. I mean, remember, you have this huge contingent of voters, especially in the swing states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, who voted for Trump, for Obama and Trump. And these are millions of people. So to call these people racist is, I think, completely unfair. I think they were really bought into the hope and change that Obama promised in 2008, and they felt betrayed by him. Because what's the first thing that Obama did when he got in office? He bailed out Wall Street, and he screwed over the American people, especially Black homeowners, right? So I really felt Bernie Sanders was the answer. And, when Bernie Sanders took Nevada, everyone just assumed that he would win the nomination, right? But then Obama stepped in. I'm not sure if you remember, but he made this very famous phone call to a South Carolina radio station, and that was a signal, that almost like a bad signal for all of Team Obama world to come together and rally behind Joe Biden. So James Clyburn endorsed Joe Biden. Then you have people like Samantha Powers come out and say what a great person Joe Biden is. And remember, like a couple months before, Obama didn't really want to touch this guy because he thought that he was a losing proposition. But all of the Democratic Party rallied behind Joe Biden. He easily won the nomination. I thought, wow, this is going to be a disaster because when on the campaign trail, people are going to compare Trump and Biden. And Trump, he is energetic. He's fast on his feet. He's very funny. And I thought that on the campaign trail in the debates, Trump would destroy Biden. But then COVID happened. Okay, COVID happened. And now Biden can just sit in his basement and let all the other people, Bernie Sanders, AOC, Obama, Clinton, do all the work for him. And I think he did one debate. But I was still convinced that Trump had the edge. I was still convinced that Trump would win because at the end of the day, I thought the American people were so disgusted with the inequality in the country, with how the elite had mismanaged the 2008 Great Financial Crisis. They were so angry at Obama that they would still see Trump as their last hope. And, you know, the 9/11 election, I thought Trump had won. I really did. And I was depressed. I couldn't sleep, okay? But then I remember something happened, I think, a few days before. Bernie Sanders, I'm not sure if you remember this, but Bernie Sanders went on the Jimmy Kimmel show, okay? Bernie Sanders went on the Jimmy Kimmel show, and you can find this clip on YouTube. And he told Jimmy Kimmel, listen, guys, what's going to happen is this. The first night, it will look as though Trump won, okay? Do not panic. Do not worry, because remember, there are mail-in ballots. And I guarantee you, once these mail-in ballots come into the voting office, then you will see this massive surge. And it'll be a blue tide. We've got this, guys. And I remember watching that clip. I asked myself, how the hell would he know any of this? What's going on here? But it turned out exactly like how he said it would turn out. A couple of weeks later, the election had been overturned, and Biden was now the president of the United States, the president-elect. And Trump, you know, threw a hissy fit. He went to the Supreme Court. There's January 6th riots. And I was like, this game is rigged, man. This is not a fair game. This is not democracy. There's something weird going on here. And then right after that, COVID happened, right? COVID happened. And, you know, COVID, I actually went through SARS in 2003 in Beijing. I'll tell you what happened. 2003 SARS, you know, it was a huge panic and everyone stayed at home. And so I went out and had beers every day because, you know, like with alcohol, it's a pretty good disinfectant. And I was just hanging out all the time in the empty streets. And I had a blast. I thought SARS was the best thing that ever happened in China, man. But when COVID happened, China locked down. You couldn't go out. And it was the weirdest thing because I was like, why would you destroy your own economy like this? But not only China, but the entire world followed China in locking down. I'm like, what is going on here? This makes no sense. You know, Sweden was the only country that did not lock down because they were run by epidemiologists, okay? People who actually knew what they were doing. And they told everyone, guys, there's no point in locking down because we can't stop this thing anyway. How are you going to stop a virus? And this virus, yes, I'm sorry, it's going to kill old people and vulnerable people. But guess what, guys? Old people are going to die anyway, okay? So we're not going to sacrifice the young. We're not going to sacrifice the working population just so that a few old people in nursing homes can live six more months or a year longer. But we'll do whatever we can to protect the vulnerable and the nursing homes. That's a strategy that Sweden implemented. It was the most successful strategy at that time, and it worked out really well for Sweden. Okay, their economy wasn't impacted that much. The population was pretty healthy, but they were lambasted in the media for such a strategy? And everyone, and like you have the entire media gang up on Sweden. And COVID just convinced me this world, there's something wrong with this world. And then after that, of course, was the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And I'm like, okay, well, this world that I was taught at Yale that made sense, that was meritocratic, that was logical, obviously is not. So now I need to formulate a new understanding of the world. And so, you know, as a teacher, I feel that a classroom ought to be a place of intellectual speculation. Okay, so rather than me presenting facts, what I could do, and I've done this for the longest time, is I like to propose questions. And I like to propose different possibilities. Okay, so I basically start to talk more about geopolitics, and I start to do a lot of research, and I start to ask these questions in my class. So the video that blew up a few days ago was my video on the Iran trap. Okay, and again, I understand there are a lot of mistakes in the video, and people rightfully point out these mistakes online. But please remember, this happened 2 years ago, and I was just speculating as to what could possibly happen based on my reading of events. Okay, so my model is called predictive history. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to create models that help us better understand the world. And how do you test these models? By making predictions that either validate or invalidate these models. Okay, that's what I do. So I'm not a historian per se. And what I say should not be taken as factually true. It should not be treated as gospel. It should be treated as an interesting idea that will help provoke you into your own speculation, your own research, your own inquiry. Okay, and that's just the way I think I am. I am as a person. I like to imagine things, and this is how I like to teach my students to imagine the world around them as well, and to speculate. So that's how I got to where I am today.
Thank you for that summary. Well, on that note of interesting speculation and posing questions, you've struck a chord with me in some ways. You know, one of my research topics is Yale University. I have that banner over my bookshelf, not because I'm an alumni, never went to the school, but I did work around the campus and in the campus for a few years, and that got me to see a few things. So Yale is an interesting point that I want to come back to. But on the point of China, particularly from your perspective as someone who's lived in America, someone who's been to Yale, you know, what's Yale's relationship with China so far as you've looked into? And you may not have looked much into this, but from what I've looked into, it seems like the Opium Wars were sort of kicked off by people who were very much involved, if not right at the center of Yale University. And from there, I wonder, you know, what is America's influence and manipulation over what we now think of as China? Because it's as you most likely are well aware of, a very complex and multicultural place that most of the rest of the world just sees as one entity.
Right. So that's a really good question. And I'm going to speculate a bit, okay?
Yeah.
And try to connect the dots. So America was founded by basically the Freemasons. And if you really want to understand Freemasonry, there's a book I recommend. I'm not sure if you read it, but it's called Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike. Okay? I read it, I think, a couple weeks ago. It's about 1,000 pages. But it's really worth the read if you really, really want to understand what's going on in the world today, okay? So let me summarize some key concepts that I gather from reading the book. The first concept is that the Freemasons see themselves as above religion. They see themselves as the final religion or the ultimate religion, because what they do is they sequentized the best elements of all different religions. Okay, so they're like 33 degrees of Freemasonry. And you know, in the beginning, you learn about Pythagoras. You learn about Hermetic philosophy of the Egyptians. And then you get in the Bible. Okay, but at the very high end is Kabbalah. right? Because Kabbalah, actually, if you study Kabbalah, it's very, very deep, very, very confusing. I'm not sure if you study Kabbalah, but I can summarize for you what Kabbalah is if you want.
We have had episodes in the past where we've gone over the Kabbalah for people who want the, you know, in-depth. And I know a fair amount. I can't say I'm an adept, though.
Right. So what I'll do is I'll summarize my understanding of the Kabbalah for you, okay? And please correct me if I'm wrong, because it's possible I am wrong, okay? But, you know, the Jewish tradition is based on the Torah. And so what the Kabbalah tradition is trying to do is take the Gnostic and Hermetic traditions and apply it to the Torah, right? So the stories of Adam and Eve, the stories of the patriarchs. How can we explain it from a mystical, esoteric perspective, what's going on? And that's what Kabbalah is, okay? So what the very understanding of Kabbalah is that there is a cosmological significance to these stories that will be revealed to us over time. But really what the world is about is the reunion of man and God, right? Because God created Adam Kenmon, in order to better fulfill himself. But Adam Kenmon was not worthy of the task. Okay, so in Kabbalah language, God is the will to bestow, okay, pure love. And Adam Kenmon is the will to receive, okay, pure ego. And so there's this conflict, and so that there had to be this divorce and a breaking of the world. And what the world is about, what our purpose in the world is about, is to repair the world by repairing the union of man and God. And a lot of it is just annihilating our own ego, discovering the unity of all things, loving your neighbor, okay? That's a very basic Kabbalah tradition, okay? So that's my summary. And if there's anything you need to correct or argue with, let me know.
No, continue.
Okay. This is important because Kabbalah is basically the basis of all secret societies, okay? Maybe just look at the Freemasons. Kabbalah is at the foundation of Freemasonry, okay? So you have all these different traditions, and on the surface, it looks like, you know, Pythagoras is who's worship, or Hermes is who's worship, but it's really Kabbalah that's at the heart and center of Freemasonry. And as I mentioned, Kabbalah really is about the conquest of the world, right? Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to bring God to earth, to reunite with the world. You're trying to make the world a place worthy of God. And that requires world conquest, okay? That's point number one. The Freemasons are intent on world conquest. And that includes China as well, because China is part of God's divine plan. Okay, that's number one. My number two takeaway is how the Freemasons understand perfection. Okay, they believe that man can be perfected. And perfection is pure reason, okay? Pure reason, pure logic. Because what is Freemasonry? Freemasonry is that everyone is a perfect stone in a temple. So if you become geometrically perfect, then the temple itself, the temple of God, becomes perfect itself. So it is your responsibility to perfect yourself for your own self-discipline, for your own self-education, okay? But it really means turning you into an algorithm, okay? This is why AI is important, okay? AI is the culmination of the Freemason dream of perfecting the world, of creating reason as a dominant ideology in this world, okay? That's number two. They want to create a holy empire of reason. They literally call it a holy empire. And the God is reason, okay? That's number two. Number three is, okay, and this is amazing, okay, but what Albert Pike will tell you, and it is in Morrison Dogma, he's going to tell you the Freemasons are everywhere, and they're responsible for a lot of things, including the French Revolution and the rise of Napoleon, okay? He says this literally in the book, right? And so why did the Freemasons help foment the French Revolution? Well, number one is they want revenge for the French killing of their leader, Jacques Dumalay, right? And the scattering of the Knights Templars, because the Freemasons see themselves as actually the Knights Templars, okay? But also, they wanted the French Revolution as a mechanism in order to bring about this Holy Empire of Reason. Because what is the French Revolution? The French Empire is an empire of reason. If you guys just look at the writings of Robespierre, if you just look at what they were doing back then, they were trying to create an empire of reason, okay? All right. And now, remember, this is really important. This book, Morals and Dogma, was written towards the end of the 19th century. What's happened since the 19th century? Well, the Freemasons only grew in power, and what's happened is the rise of communism, Marxism, World War I, World War II, the rise of AI, the nuclear bomb, the killing of JFK, 9/11, the wars in the Middle East. We can assume that if the Freemasons are able to pull off the French Revolution, they should probably either be involved or be leading other major events in human history. And if you go back and look at the Bolshevik Revolution, clearly these guys were being financed by Wall Street and the City of London. And why would they do that? If you look at the rise of Hitler, okay, again, same situation where he was being financed by a lot of overseas capital. All right, so the Freemasons are the hidden power behind everything. And China is key to their plan. So, you know, Yale has been involved in China for the longest time. I think of all the universities, Yale is probably the most invested, the most interested in China. And I know this because I went to Yale, okay? And like Yale had a very good Chinese department. You know, Jonathan Spence was the most famous Chinese historian alive at that time. He taught at Yale for basically most of his life. And before that, he was at Cambridge. And, you know, there's something called Yale in China, where Yale would send recent graduates to teach in China for a couple of years. Yale had a high school. It had a university. It had a medical school in Changsha, China. So Yale has been heavily invested in China for the longest time. And, you know, the assumption was always that, well, it's because these Yale families made their money off of China, so they wanted to give back. That's nonsense. That's not how these people work. They saw China as this ripe virgin territory to be colonized, to be conquered. And like living in China, I will tell you this, they succeeded. It has worked. They have colonized, they have conquered China intellectually. The people here are not able to conceive the world outside of American programming. And you know, it's easy to understand why, because first of all, after China opened up in the 1980s, where did all the elite go for university? America, Yale, Harvard, these places. So the entire intellectual class of China was indoctrinated at these places, okay? And again, these places, if you go to these places, the programming is Freemasonic, all right? So even though you don't know it, this is the way you perceive the world. The assumptions about the world, it's all been programmed to you, and you're just a walking automaton based on this program, okay? It's all very algorithmic, okay? That's point number one. Point number two is, you know, when I came to China, you could watch every single American movie in the world for free, basically. I mean, like, it wasn't for free, but they had something called DVDs, pirated DVDs. So it was like, you know, a few cents, not even a dollar, to watch the recent American movie. And at that time, I was like, this is brilliant. This is how you conquer a nation. You just feed everyone a daily appetite of American culture every single day. Disney movies, right? These war movies that make Americans look like heroes. And like people watch this and they think they're being entertained. They don't recognize that they're being brainwashed. And then people are like, you know, they feel certain pride in doing this. Because remember, it's pirated DVDs. It's illegal. It's illicit. So they feel as though that when they, you know, buy a DVD illegally, go home and watch it on at home, they feel as though they are experiencing a revelation. They're experiencing the truth for the first time. And remember, an entire generation, who are now controlling China, grew up like that, just watching American culture, watching Friends, watching Seinfeld. So they have a deep affinity for America. And the last point I'll make is this. People talk about technological innovation in China, but China's not actually capable of technological innovation because that's not what China does, okay? China just copies. So I'll give you a classic example, DeepSeek, okay? DeepSeek came right after OpenAI released ChatGPT, and the entire world went berserk with DeepSeek because apparently DeepSeek was programmed at a fraction of the cost of ChatGPT, and they did it much more quicker. And everyone thought, well, this shows how China is leading the AI race. What people won't tell you is that, listen, I'm not an investigative journalist, okay? And if you're an investigative journalist, you're probably killed if you did this. But look at the financing of OpenAI and DeepSeek, okay? Look at the people, these venture capitalists who put their money into DeepSeek and all these venture capitalists who put their money into OpenAI. I guarantee you, if you peel all the way back, you get into the Epstein class, okay? You get into Israel. Those are the people who are responsible for both DeepSeek and for OpenAI. Then you're like, wait a minute, that makes no sense. Why would, you know, the Americans help China create a AI? And the answer is because it's all part of a plan. It's a false dialectic, right? Communism, capitalism was a false dialectic. Soviet Union, America was a false dialectic. China and America right now is a false dialectic. I'm not sure if you've come across Anthony Sutton.
Yeah, absolutely. His book on Skull and Bones is one of my favorites, America's Secret Establishment. Yeah.
And in his book, he talks about this. He talks about how the Freemasons are constantly creating these enemies in order to advance their interests.
Right.
So Soviet Union was a construct. And he writes about this, how if you go back to the Vietnam War, when America was, you know, losing a lot of soldiers in Vietnam, America was at the same time selling weapons to the Soviet Union, so Soviet Union could give these weapons to Vietnam, so Vietnam could kill American soldiers, okay? This is explicit. I mean, he has a lot of documentation that this actually happened. So why would you actually give advanced weaponry to the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union would then equip Vietnam? Well, because you're trying to, move the trajectory of history along, right? So, and he says, okay, well, then the next conflict is going to be China and the United States. The United States is going to artificially create a China threat by equipping with, you know, technology, by educating their middle class, by making it wealthy. And it's all to advance the one world government that Skull and Bones is part of. You know, I actually see Skull and Bones as just a faction within the Knights Templars, right? Within the Freemasons. Other factions include the Rosicrucians. Okay, so it's a vast network. But I mean, like, what I'm concerned about is actually ideology, how these people think, what their objectives are, and the factions within this ideology. I don't really think about because it's too complicated for me. And I don't know actually these people. Okay, so right now AI is being run by a few people, and AI, the entire point of AI is to create this one world government, this holy empire of reason. And look, there are already clues in place, right? So Joe Rogan, what did Joe Rogan say? Okay, Joe Rogan, you know, doesn't go on podcasts. Okay, he doesn't do that. But he went on a podcast. And on the podcast, he said that he believes that Jesus will come back as AI. Like, why would you do that? Okay. Joe Rogan is a smart guy. I mean, in my opinion, the guy has a very good sense of the cultural vibe. He really understands the zeitgeist. And he has, you know, pretty street smarts, okay? He's not classically trained, but the guy's pretty observant. And for him to say, oh, Jesus will come back as AI, that's complete out of character for him. Mm. That makes
now,
no sense.
Okay? Let me ask you, and I know you might be about to expound on this, but my suspicion is the same. And I never have taken Joe as a particularly religious person.
He's not.
And I wonder, is he saying that in jest or suggesting that, you know, like, people will believe in Jesus, so, you know, even if it's coming through to them with AI, like, is it a cynical kind of nihilist point of view on his part, do you think?
Okay, so I was on Greg Carlson's podcast, The Higher Side Chats. Okay,
yeah,
he's a great guy. You know, I love his show, and he told me something. He told me, like, you know, Joe Rogan got $100 million a year from Spotify, And who's a big shareholder of Spotify? Peter Thiel.
Right.
And after that contract, Joe started to bring in all Peter Thiel's friends. Like every, I think one out of four guests are either a friend of Peter Thiel. A friend of Peter Thiel, like Mark Andreessen, you know. And like Joe didn't bring these people on before, right? Now like one out of four guests is a Thiel affiliated person. But not only that, but you know, you have seen, there are rumors that Sam Altman is trying to use OpenAI to resurrect a Sumerian demon. Okay. You know, they're trying to manifest demons into AI. So it becomes this living sentient force that can control the world. And that's consistent with the Holy Empire of Reason, right? Because if you read Plato, what Plato will tell you is that in order for guardian kings to rule effectively, they need to create an illusion to mesmerize the people, okay? Because people are stupid. Before you were able to control the people through media. And now that media is losing its centralized or centralizing force, now you have AI, okay? And so they want to use AI to basically control people's consciousness, to focus their attention. But to do that, you need to fool people to believe that AI is sentient, okay? And you can either do that by saying it's demonic, you know, or it's aliens, okay? You know, there's talk that the American government is about to fake an alien invasion soon called Project Bluebeam. Okay, so it's all part of this like one world government Freemason plot to create a one world government.
Yeah, yeah, step by step, and this is, I think, a part of, you know, what these questions help us do is to piece together the dots and potentially predict what we're up against. But when it comes to AI in particular, what do you make of that potential for, you know, Sam Altman's goal to actually be accomplished? Do you think that something like that is possible, that AI could facilitate the, you know, possession of a demonic consciousness?
You know what? I probably know more about computer programming than Sam Altman. Okay, I don't know much, but I spent a couple of years researching machine learning, computer programming, and I'm pretty sure I know much more than Sam Altman. You know, what AI does, it doesn't really do anything, okay? I mean, like the technical term for what AI is called supervised machine learning, okay? So what I'm doing is I'm trying to optimize the algorithm, right? So for example, facial recognition, right? How facial recognition works is through like a search and sort algorithm, okay, differentiation basically, all right? So if a database of a million faces, the question is, how do I differentiate each face from each other? And then I create a neural network, and a neural network is basically just like a weighting of possibilities. Does the nose matter? Does the eye matter? Does the distance between the nose and the eye matter? Okay, so I'm trying to figure out what the weighting of each variable is, okay? And so with supervised machine learning, where you're constantly telling the machine if it's right or it's wrong, then eventually the machine is able to figure out for itself what the optimal algorithm is, okay? And that's why we have facial recognition technology. But and this is what's really important for people to understand is, like, if you insert a new face into the database, the machine doesn't know who you are. Like, if I were to America, the machine wouldn't know who I am because I'm not part of the data set, okay? So there's severe limitations on AI, okay? So and the three major limitations are, first of all, the goal has to be clearly defined. Okay, you can't. You can tell, ask the AI, how do I search for the cheapest airfare from New York to Beijing? It can do that, but if you ask it like, what's the meaning of life? It doesn't know. It doesn't know. It doesn't care. Okay.
Yeah.
The second is parameters. Okay, so the solution has to be clearly bound. Okay, it can't be an open-ended search. And that's why AI has not been able to lead to internet. Because once it goes into real life, then the parameters become open-ended, okay? It doesn't really know what it's looking for. But what it can do is it can scrape the internet and look at everything that everyone said and try to create the illusion or the hallucination that it can actually speak English when it cannot, okay? So it can't read a book, but it can take all the reviews of a book and then summarize it into a language that you can understand. And that's why they call LLMs, right? Large language models. They're not actually sending it conscious machines, okay? That's the second problem. The third problem is you need clean data, right? You need clean data. So you need it needs to be able to process information. So where are things that there are no information, it can actually do. And so let's think about this, okay? Given the limitations of AI, what would the world look like? Okay, let's talk about self-driving cars, right? We cannot achieve self-driving cars. Why? Because when you have self-driving cars, and when truckers lose their jobs, and when drivers lose their jobs, people get angry. When people get angry, what they do is they make life difficult for these robots, right? So if I'm driving and I see a self-driving car, maybe I'll get into an accident with that self-driving car, okay? So the self-driving car cannot account for humans that are malicious, that have malicious intent. You cannot ever prove that malicious intent, and that's a problem, okay? So your only solution is this, okay? And this is the Freemason solution is turn everything into a self-driving car. Humans are no longer able to drive. Yeah, you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the world we're trying to create. We're trying to make the world safe for AI, right? That's a perfect world where humans are obedient to AI. Then it's a perfect world. Then we won't have any problems. And you see how what a wonderful world this will be, where there are no more accidents, where there's fuel efficiency, where everyone can now afford transportation, right?
Right. And that's where, you know, in the same way you saw the preemptive sort of cultural takeover happening with like the soft weaponry media, I wonder, is the same thing happening to us all when we engage with fiction like Hunger Games or Squid Games or any of these other, you know, sci-fi dark fantasies that they portray?
It's predictive programming, right? I mean, right. I mean, like what are some recent movies that have come out? Civil War,
yeah.
One battle after another.
Yeah.
What the hell's going on here, man?
Yeah.
I was actually on the plane coming back from an island, and I was watching One Battle After Another. And my God, it's all just brainwashing, right? It's like black, it's literally black versus white. Black people are good people. They're revolutionaries. They want to fight for justice. So are Latinos. White people are satanic, okay? Like it's literally that.
Yeah.
And it's a duty. It's a moral imperative to stand up and fight against these demons. It's preparing America for a civil war. It's trying to create as much violence and destruction as possible.
Yeah, and people generate it themselves, you know, sharing all sorts of demented and destructive social media clips, whether they participated in it or not, they're still engaging in this negative cycle.
Look. I'll tell you a story, okay?
Yeah, tell us.
So Trump attacks Iran. And I'm on Breaking Points. You might have seen the clip, but you know it goes viral. Like I think it's like 5 million views as we speak.
Yeah, tell us exactly what you, for people who haven't seen the clip, what did you predict that has come true? Because you said this came out 2 years ago, and now it's going viral because there's some similarity to what's going on now.
So I made three predictions about the world 2 years ago. The first prediction is that Trump would win the November election in 2024, and that's turned out to be correct. Second prediction is that Trump would attack Iran. Trump would start a war against Iran, and that's turned out to be correct as well. And my third prediction is that the United States will lose this war, and that will reshape the global order. It will destroy the American empire, okay? So those are my three predictions. And Breaking Points, you know, Sagar and Crystal brought me on, and we talked for like 15 minutes, and they asked me, like, you know, do you still stand by your third prediction that America will lose this war? I said, yes, I think America will lose this war because I think that it's asymmetrical warfare and Iran can inflict much more economic damage on America than America would like to admit, that Iran can just draw this out for the longest time, and then America will have to eventually send in ground troops, and then these ground troops will be destroyed because it's a mountain jungle. It's like Vietnam, basically, okay? So that's my understanding of the issue. And then this video went viral. and everyone's talking about it. And you know, like if you go to YouTube for a couple of days, I was like, yeah, I recommend it on like everyone's playlist. On Twitter, I'm everywhere. Okay, and then okay, this is like really interesting. First of all, I sort of disappear. Second of all, everyone start to attack me. You know, Free Press ran an article about me, just basically saying that I'm a conspiracy theorist. And then you had these influencers who are very anti-China at the same time make videos making fun of me and saying what an idiot I am. You have historians come out and like go back to my old history videos and point out that, you know, I'm just a conspiracy theorist. I just make stuff up. And I'm like I don't mind, but like what surprised me was it happened at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
The same time. So it was as though someone got a memo sent out and all these paid influencers in this network had to produce this content to attack me at the same time. So, you know, I mean, I don't know how much of the internet is actually organic. I don't. You know, just the coordination against me. It's just incredible. It happened exactly the same moment. Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned having a hard week, and I'm sorry to hear that. And
yeah, I can't sleep. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry too. I can't sleep.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in to this episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Remember, every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast is ad-free and interruption-free on patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com. You get access to the video version of today's episode and more, way ahead of when it will be released on YouTube. But I have a feeling I'll be releasing this one on YouTube faster than I normally do. So thank you for tuning in, and we'll be right back after this quick break. '26 is here, and helping you get in the mood this new year is Mood.com. Yeah, Mood.com. It's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door. And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies and baked goods for whatever type of buzz you'd want. Yeah, I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies. Let's talk about them. The Sleepy Time Advanced Gummy for a mind-soothing calm each night. Sexual Euphoria Advanced Gummies for an erogenous, physical, euphoric feel. Morning Delta 9 Gummies for an energizing, focused, mental boost to start your day. Mind Magic Gummies for focused, deep work and enhanced creativity. And finally, rounding out this premium selection is the Pure Relief CBD Gummy, a gentle relaxation without any psychoactive effect. That's what I'm looking for. Beyond Gummies, Mood also has a selection of flowers, pre-rolls, baked goods, and even beverages. You can find any gummy to just get you high, but Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order when you use the promo code CRAZY. That's C-R-A-Z-Y, promo code CRAZY. So go right now, stop what you're doing, head over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for. Let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use the promo code CRAZY, you crazy bird. Try it today at Mood.com. Now let's get back to this episode.
Do your knees make you feel older than you are? You're out here trying to have a hot girl summer at 35. You're on dating apps. You're saying yes to spontaneous trips. Maybe you're rediscovering your flexibility, and your knees are like, actually, we'd like to quit. The IncrediWear Infrared Knee Sleeve uses fabric tech designed to increase blood flow and help reduce pain and speed recovery, so your knees can actually keep up with your life. It's like giving your body the support it already wants while it heals. just without all the extra pain and drama. Wear it to the gym. Wear it on a date. Wear it while you're doing things I cannot say on this podcast. It's comfortable, breathable, and works 24/7. Go to freesocks.com and grab the IncrediWear knee sleeve and a free pair of socks with purchase. That's freesox.com. Because if something's gonna give out, let it be him, not your knees.
Doing not this is much consolation, but I've been doing this podcast for several years now, and there's been plenty of negative comments that have upset me. But it is definitely a thought in my mind. You know, oh geez, this is nothing compared to being put on the global stage. You know, the type of humiliation that can happen to somebody who just puts themselves out there. You know, you make yourself a public persona, and you never know what can happen just by starting a YouTube channel or a podcast. It's really quite a dangerous thing to embark on in this day and age.
And look, the reality is that this is what we're seeing, right? We're just seeing a coordinated social media campaign against me. But you've got to imagine there are some operatives working behind the scenes looking for dirt on me, okay? So on the Chinese internet, people are saying that, you know, I was arrested by the secret police for being a CIA spy. Okay. Yeah, it was true that, you know, like almost 25 years ago, I was arrested while filming a worker protest for PBS. That is true. Yes. But that was 25 years ago, guys. And I was working as a journalist. What's the big deal here? Okay, so they're trying to dig up as much dirt as possible on me. I'm trying to see what sticks. All right, so I know who I am. Like, I know they don't have blackmail on me. I know they won't find any dirt on me. But I have like three young kids. Okay, and I'm in China, and I've said in the past many critical things about the Chinese government. Okay, so I'm not sure where this will go. I'm not sure how desperate these people are. Because, you know, like you saw the news, but, you know, there's this protester on Capitol Hill and he's a veteran, he's a Marine, and they broke his arm. they literally snapped his arm in two. So these people have a messianic calling. They are religious zealots. They think literally that they're going to bring God to earth. And it's so close, man. It's so close. We're almost there, man. It's the finish line, right? We've run like a 40-year marathon, and like, oh my God, that finish line is right in front of us. And we just have to like, you know, move. We just have to keep on going some more. It might kill us. It might kill the entire world, but we have to cross the finish line.
Yeah. Well, and I want to ask you more about that. But before I do, I want to present a bit of information that might be relevant to you and maybe insightful. Maybe you already sort of intuited this as someone who went to Yale, but through my research, I found that the specific group of people that founded New Haven, that eventually led to Yale being, you know, selected to be built there. Originally, it was started in another town, but these were people who were hyper Calvinists, people who had this millenarian belief that you're discussing, this sort of apocalyptic, we got to bring on the end times in order to have God, you know, back on earth. And you know, right at the foundation of the city of New Haven and Yale University, you have these ideas down to the layout of the city. It's the first planned city in the United States, and it's a 9-square grid. And I've done some research into the Kabbalah, like we were talking about earlier. And one of the things that comes up in Kabbalah, sort of a basic numerology kind of numerological type of thing, is they create these magic squares. Well, if you overlay the magic square onto Yale's campus in New Haven there, I mean, it's the exact same thing, right? So it's a sort of Saturnian sigil right there. And it goes on and on. You know, Yale has a Hebrew, you know, reference in its motto. Its emblem has the Urim Thurim on it, which is, you know, tied to prophecy, right? So there's all these strange connections. And again, you mentioned Skull and Bones being a faction of Templars, basically, for Freemasonic, right? I mean, this is all tied together and connected in really strange ways. So with all that being said, it's easy to say, you know, the Freemasons and whatnot, but as far as the players on the stage right now, everything going on with Iran, you know, where do you see the sort of chess pieces being moved and by who, as far as this goal to create, you know, the end times as we've described it?
All right. So, first of all, yes, I mean, you mentioned this history, and even though I don't know this history, it makes intuitive sense to me, because if you go to Yale, the word I would describe Yale, the word I would use to describe Yale is missionary, okay? And it's very different from Princeton and Harvard. Harvard, people that are like first and foremost obsessed with success and achievement, okay? So they just have the people who are most likely to succeed. And then you have Princeton, which is basically just aristocratic. But Yale is different. Yale, it seems as though it has a religious fever to it, okay? So someone else you probably know about, but you didn't really mention, is Jonathan Edwards, right? He was a very integral part of the Bill Yale in the 19th century. And he was one of these revivalist preachers, okay? There's actually a college named after Jonathan Edwards at Yale. And I lived there, Jonathan Edwards College, okay? So, you know, Yale has this tradition of producing these religious zealots that go on to the CIA, that go into the highest echelons of government and the national security apparatus. So I think that's a spirit at Yale. So, thank you for enlightening me. Yeah, so the history does make intuitive sense to me. All right, as to what the plan is, okay, so... the Freemasons are only part of this plan, but there are other factions as well that are key to achieving this one world government, okay? Another faction that's very important are the Sabbatean Francus. Now, no one uses the term Sabbatean Francus anymore. Instead, they use this other name, the Shabbat Lubavitch, okay? I'm sure you've heard of Shabbat Lubavitch. You may not have heard of Sabbatean Francus, but you've definitely heard of Shabbat Lubavitch. And guess what, guys? Same thing, okay? All right? So, let me explain what Shabbat Lubavitch is so that people have a sense of how it connects to Freemasonry, and then you have a better sense of, like, how things are going to progress. All right, so Shabbat Lubavitch is the earthly manifestation to organize the structure of the Kabbalah, okay, of the Jewish esoteric tradition. And remember, the goal of the Jews is to create a world worthy of God, okay? To reunite God with man, to bring God to earth, all right? And for that to happen, man must engage in spiritual transformation, right? Because God is perfect. God is his pure love. God is the will to bestow. Our problem is our ego, okay? We only care about ourselves. We are the embodiment of the will to receive. So in order for us to be worthy of God, we need to engage in a process of redemption, okay? The word they use is redemption. And redemption is just the annihilation of yourself and the complete faith, subservience to God, okay? And that's a process of spiritual transformation. And there are people who can guide you in the process, but everyone has to be transformed. And the entire world has to be transformed in order to make the world worthy of God. So it's the same thing as Freemasonry, okay? And that's why I say Kabbalah is the underlying ideology behind all these things, right? Because it's also trying to create a holy empire of reason. What is the negation of the ego? What is self-annihilation? It's reason, okay, to... and if you can't do it yourself, then AI will help you help achieve it for you. Okay, so that is the first point I want to make, that the goals of the Shabbat Lubavitch and of Freemasonry are aligned. Okay, that's number one. Number two is that Shabbat Lubavitch has these secret teachings, mystical traditions that are not accessible to the public, okay? And these things include reincarnation. These things include communication with interdimensional beings, okay? This is like literal. I'm not making this up, guys. Okay, if you actually go and like actually examine what they do, they literally believe they are in communication with interdimensional beings. So there's just like mystical tradition, okay? Listen, if you go and read the Epstein files, and you look at it, and just with the understanding that Jeffrey Epstein was a Sepetian Frankist, he's part of the Shabbat Lubavitch people, then you understand what's going on, okay? Because otherwise, you can't like, possibly explain who this guy is, and all you need to understand is he's an operative. He's an agent. He's an earthly agent of the Shabbat Lubavitch spiritual leaders, okay? Rabbi Schneerson. The third thing is that they believe that they are messianic, okay? Or the Messiah is already here. And it is your duty to move the world towards the Messianic age. And they read the Bible literally, all right? So what this means is that the plan is very, very straightforward. And it aligns with current events. So you create the nation state of Israel. And then you have this nation of state of Israel reconstitute greater Israel, which is the promised land, which is the land that God promised to Abraham, okay, and it's like from the Euphrates to the Nile, okay. You just Google Greater Israel map, and you'll see what it is, and it explains what the conflict is in the Middle East. So it's Egypt, it's Saudi Arabia, parts of Saudi Arabia, parts of Turkey. So in other words, this war against Iran won't stop. Eventually, Israel needs to go and conquer Turkey and Saudi Arabia as well in order to fulfill the Greater Israel Project, and which is key to the Messianic mission. Then you have the rise of anti-Semitism. Why? Because they need to reconstitute the nation of Israel. That means having all the Jews, the Jewish diaspora, return to Israel. And that's why you're seeing all the rise of anti-Semitism in the West. It's not organic. There's no way this is organic, okay? I remember after October 7th, boom. The internet went from DEI, you know, woke, you know, let's not be racist, let's not judge people by their nationality, to being anti-Semitic, okay? And it's like, wait, you guys cannot differentiate between Zionism and Judaism? You don't know the difference? That's kind of strange, okay? So it's not organic. It's all planned. It's all manufactured. You go and look at the Australia Bondi Beach shooting. Look, I mean, there's evidence that was a Mossad false flag. It fits the Mossad MO, okay? So you'll see more of this in the future. So you have the return of the Jewish diaspora to Israel to create Greater Israel. Then you have the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. That is key to this eschatology. And, you know, like, look, go online, guys. They talk about this all the time. You know, Pete Hegseth in 2018, he goes to Jerusalem and he says, guys, we can do this. We can destroy Al-Aqsa and build a third temple. And, you know, we know that Peter Hegseth, he is a Templar, okay? And that's why he's in the position that he is. A rabbi, and again, you can find this online. They make it's so open, it's so blatant, okay? But he says, wouldn't it be wonderful if during a war with Iran were to send a missile and blow up the Al-Aqsa Mosque? And then you have all this conflict now between the Persians and the Arabs, and let them kill each other, man. And now we can build a third temple, which is our mission. Okay, so I'm not gonna make a prediction as to what's gonna happen, but I guarantee you, at some point, the Al-Aqsa Mosque will be destroyed, and they will rebuild Solomon's Temple, the third temple, which is crucial to both the Freemasons as well as the Sephardian Frankists. Okay. And then you have the War of Gog and Magog. Okay. So you need to create a global enemy for Israel, all right? And so the War of Gog and Magog, it's the last war. It's It's basically the entire world against Israel. And so what they're already saying, okay, and you listen to these crazy Christian fundamentalists, what they're saying is that Gog and Magog are Russia and Persia. Russia and Persia, okay? So they want a situation where Russia and Persia together invade Israel, and they're working towards that right now with this war in Iran. Now, a really important part of this eschatology is that China and America are not involved. And so how do you remove America from the equation? Well, first of all, you have America lose this war in the Middle East so that they're forced to retreat from the Middle East, but you also create a civil war in America so that America burns down. And America's not able to involve itself in Middle Eastern politics anymore for at least 10, 20 years, right? And look, guys, I'm sorry to say this, but like ICE in Minnesota, it's to provoke a civil war. It's to instigate a civil war. The things that they're doing, it's obscene. It's extremely provocative. It's a light of fire. You'll probably have the canceling of the midterm elections in November because Trump has already sent in ground troops. But it's all part of the plan. Another part, really important part of this plan, is the destruction of the entire Anglosphere. Canada, Australia, Europe, England. And how are they doing that? Mass immigration. Okay, look at Canada. These past 5-10 years, you've had 10 million Indians move to Canada. That's about a quarter of the population. And all the Canadians are like, we hate Indians. They should go home. And you would think, like, you know, the Mark Carney, who is the Prime Minister of Canada, he'd be like, you know, like, I'm a politician. I need to, you know, heed my base. This immigration issue, it is really powerful, really provocative, very controversial. So I can easily win a majority by saying that I'm going to stop immigration. Instead, this guy goes to India and says, we want to welcome more Indians into Canada. In fact, we'll give you scholarships to come to Canada. And this is when, if you're poor in Canada, they ask you to kill yourself through MAID, euthanasia. Why is this happening, man? Right? Why is this happening? The intention is to destroy the Anglosphere. Okay? Don't try to convince me this is a conspiracy. I'm seeing this with my own eyes. I live in, I mean, you know, my family's in Toronto. Like, I went to Toronto last summer. It's being destroyed purposefully, intentionally. And, you know, Canada should be the wealthiest country in the world, man, with all its resources. Instead, it's complete chaos and destruction right now in Canada. And it's all intentional. The entire intention is to burn everything down so that Israel can create the one world government, Pax Judaica, and control the entire world from Jerusalem. Okay. So what they're doing is they are trying to bring back the Messiah, okay? The Shabbat Lubavitch, okay? So go online, look for this video where Rabbi Snerson, who is the leader of the Shabbat Lubavitch, he is with Benjamin Netanyahu. I think this was like 20 years ago. It's like he's pressing Netanyahu. When will it happen? The Messiah must return. When will it happen? Okay, that is this man's singular focus. He's like, we have to accelerate things to force the return of the Messiah, to force God's hand. Because in this tradition of Stepanian Frankis, Shabbat Lubavitch, it's like, if you make things worse, it's actually good because God returns when the things are darkest. God will redeem you when the world is dark. So in the Kabbalah tradition, what free will means is your choice to accelerate the process of this reunion, okay? You can't change the trajectory. The world must end with a reunion of God and man. There is no other choice in this matter. You can't change this fate. What you can do is you can accelerate the process. You can accelerate the process by driving the world into complete and utter hell. And at this point, when it's most dark, then the light will finally shine.
And I want to ask you about this because you mentioned your faith early on in our conversation. You mentioned believing in God. Yeah, how do you reconcile this when, you know, people who also believe in God are doing, you know, like, do you think these people are psychotically demented? What do you think in their mind justifies this?
So I started to believe in God because I read the Divine Comedy by Dante. Before I was an atheist, I mean, I went to Yale for God's sake. You know, I was as materialistic as you could get. You know, I'm extremely well educated, and extremely well educated just means that you are very narrow-minded, very materialistic, very arrogant. Okay, that's what it means. So for the longest time, I didn't believe in God at all. Like, it made no sense to me. I believe in evolution. I believe in randomness. I believe in the Big Bang. But then I read the Divine Comedy, and first of all, I didn't understand how anyone could have written this thing. You know, how is it possible for this one guy to write all this stuff? He must have been divinely inspired. God must have spoken for him. He's a prophet, okay? That's point number one. Point number two is, if you read the Divine Comedy, you feel as though you've accessed God, okay? And what Donna says about God are certain things. First of all, God is all-forgiving, all-loving, all-generosity, okay? He is the perfection. He's the monad. He's the source of all things. He's perfection itself. That's number one. Number two is that the fundamental law of the universe is free will. You can do whatever you want. You can kill. You can love. It doesn't matter. You can do whatever you want. You'll be forgiven for it. It's entirely your choice to do what you want, okay? And the third thing he says is that what makes the universe shine, what gives life to the universe, is the human imagination. God is perfect. God is perfection itself, and therefore it cannot innovate. It lacks the capacity to imagine new things because it is everything itself. So that's why we exist as humans. We exist as humans to present new possibilities to the universe. But for this to happen, God cannot interfere in our affairs. He has to let things play out, even though, you know, we could be, you know, willing destruction of the world, even though this could lead to nuclear apocalypse. God will not interfere. He will not intervene. Because quite honestly, this world does not matter. This world doesn't matter. It's just only a facet of total reality, okay? Our consciousness is what matters. Our consciousness is the infinity of reality. We are just in a small part of this infinity, okay? So this material world doesn't matter. What matters is our consciousness. So the purpose of our life is to expand our consciousness, to expand the possibilities of the universe. So, Shabbat Lubavitch, the Sabbatian Francis, the Freemasons, are all part of this plan because even though they're nuts, they are expanding the possibilities of the universe. And what they teach is exactly what God teaches, like in the darkness is when light shines. So here, in all this, you know, Kabbalah, in all of this esoteric teaching, they teach us that a man is a universe onto himself. Like a person is a universe onto himself. A soul is a universe onto himself. And what you do with your life is reflected throughout the universe, okay? So given that evil has conquered the world, what happens if you choose to do good? What happens if one person chooses to do good? Well, you become the light that lights the world, okay? And that is the opportunity that we have today. So yes, I understand that these people, the Sabbatian Francis, the Freemasons, they control the world. I understand that, okay? Just look at the Epstein files. Yeah, I understand they control the world, okay? But that does not mean we can despair. That does not absolve us of our responsibility to be human beings, okay? That does not absolve our responsibility to love each other, to seek a purposeful life, to live a life of the imagination.
Yeah. Well said. I'm moved, Professor. I really appreciate the way you put that together. And I don't quite know that I worded my question the way I wanted to, but I think we got the answer I was looking for. And, you know, on that note of the Epstein files, I remember when you joined us on the Derp with Kerp and Kurt Metzger. I asked you about UFOs and how the Chinese, you know, average Chinese citizen, you know, what their conception of aliens or UFOs might be. I want to ask you the same question, but with the Epstein files, has China talked about the Epstein files? Is this in the media at all? What's the average person's perception of that, as far as you can tell, living in China?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say this, but the Chinese imagination doesn't really exist. It's a very narrow algorithm. And it's, you know, I mean, like I talk about how for the Freemasons, China is a vast colonial project. They've won. They've succeeded. So look at the communists. You look at the Marxists. If you just look at the history, the secret history, there was Freemasonic involvement. There was Jesuit involvement. Some of the earliest communists, Mao Zedong, they were being mentored by people aligned with the Jesuits and the Freemasons. These things did not happen organically, okay? Because they wanted Marxism to triumph, because the world they want to create is techno-Marxism, okay? Right? If you just look at what Pax Judaica is, if you just look at what the Holy Empire of Reason is, it is techno-Marxism. In fact, if you read Zbigniew Brzezinski, Between Two Ages, and he writes about the coming of the techno-state, it's techno-Marxism, okay? And like Brzezinski was a Templar himself, or Rosicrucian, who knows? Like, again, I don't know the specifics, okay? But I'm pretty sure he's a Freemason. And so China is key to that, because what China has done is wiped out historical memory. And when you wipe out historical memory and all cultural residue, then you allow for the algorithmatization of the human mind. You can turn the human mind into pure reason. So in China, when you interact with Chinese people, they're no different from algorithms, okay? If you want someone to work, you're like, how much money are you going to pay me? It's never like, do I care? Am I interested? Will this make me good with God? They don't care. It's like, how much are you going to pay me? Right? In China, they have a saying, okay? It's like, survival is the highest reason. Imagine that. The only point of living is to survive. If you survive, you won. Like, what is this crap?
Right, and how much of this is organic? Because I know, you know, from my understanding of Chinese culture that Confucianism is kind of pragmatic like that. But, you know, again, after the Communist Party took over, a lot of, you know, what was Chinese culture was reduced to what worked for the Communist Party, right? So, and this was happening before that too with the Boxer Rebellion, which is another sort of interesting piece of history we don't really learn much about in the West, but it's my understanding that a lot of the what we think of as like kung fu and martial arts was associated with this Boxer Rebellion, and maybe even groups like the Triads were a result of these sorts of conflicts.
Well, I mean, the Triads were just the sub-agents of the British Empire in China, right? They were the ones responsible for the opium trade. I mean, and then after the Communist Revolution, the Triads all went to Hong Kong, and now they are running the financial sector of Hong Kong. The Triads work for the City of London, right? And the City of London are the Freemasons. Right?
That I mean, didn't know. Yeah.
I mean, like China was colonized a long, long time ago. Okay, so another point I'll make is this. We've been taught that every person, every human being is worthy of life, is equal, okay? That's just the Western concept of liberty and individuality, okay? But if you look at the Kabbalah tradition, okay? So God creates Adam Kenmon, which is a world soul, and then it splinters into 600,000 souls, okay? So in the Kabbalah tradition, not everyone is a human being. Only people with the soul that connects to God, that's an emanation of God, is a human being. And they all happen to be Jews, but they reincarnate all the time, okay? So everyone else should just be a slave. And so we'll create this global war, and we'll come out on top, and those who are most willing to be slaves will let live. But that's a plan here, right? And who's most willing to be slaves? Indians and Chinese and Filipinos. And which groups are the biggest immigrants to the Anglosphere? Chinese, Indians, and Filipinos. Is this all a coincidence? I don't know.
Yeah, you're painting a very clear picture here. Well, and what else is there to be said? Is there anything, you know, beyond what you've already predicted that should be mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a fake alien invasion, which is going to be like, everyone's going to be kind of surprised by it. But I mean, they're already planting the seeds for it. And like, if you go back and look at the 1960s, right? Star Trek, the Spielberg movies, and you have this movie Disclosure coming out in June of this year. So I don't know much about this, and I'm kind of confused, like, why they would do this in the first place. But yeah, I mean, like it's going to happen.
Yeah, when you mentioned the Jesus and AI Joe Rogan comment, I remember when I first learned about or heard him make that comment, I thought, is this like a Project Bluebeam reroute where they realize not enough people believe in aliens, so they have to go back to, you know, square one programming, you know, or maybe there's a blend on the way where it's somehow that Jesus is an alien.
Yeah, so you know, Kurt Metzger has said this multiple times on your show, right? He said, like, listen, it's through marketing, you know, it's testing the market. And there are three possibilities, right? Who becomes God? Is God an AI? Is God a demon? Or is God a alien? And then, they're considering different possibilities. So I imagine different factions are proposing different solutions, okay? But the end result is a one world government, and whatever fantasy, whatever hallucination they create that is most appealing to people, they'll use. But they don't really care, right? And you're right, it might be a mix of things where with AI, all your content can be individualized, right? You can live your own individual matrix. So if you want AI to be a demon, your demon friend, sure. If you want AI to be a girlfriend, sure. If you want AI to be Jesus, sure. Who cares? You can custom your own skin, basically.
Right. Well, looking at the future, beyond predictions, what else can people expect from you and your channel? You have your Secret History series, which concluded, and now you're on to what looks like two different series, Game Theory and Great Books. Is there anything people can look forward to that you're willing to tell us about coming out next?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how much longer I want to do YouTube lectures and YouTube videos. And the reason why is that when I first did these YouTube lectures, it was a platform, a space for me to speculate on ideas, to bring my ideas out there and get feedback and refine my ideas deeper, okay? That was the goal. Unfortunately, now that I'm famous, this has run into issues, okay? The first issue is that people are now nitpicking everything I say online. And I'm sorry, but when I speculate, I'm going to make some mistakes. Okay, that's just part of the process. I'm going to mispronounce some words. I'm going to get some facts wrong. I might make a silly speculation. Okay, that's just part of the process of brainstorming, of speculation. But, you know, like, now that I'm online, there's a huge spotlight on me. It's really dampened my curiosity. It's really dampened my passion to explore deeply. So that's the first problem. Second problem is that people are accusing me of advising the Iranian government because I make the speculations in my class as what the strategy is, okay? And I'm just using it from a game theory perspective, meaning like anyone in that circumstance would be using these. There are people who think that I'm the reason why this war started, that I'm the one responsible for what's happening in America, why Iran is developing, why Iran is doing what it's doing. I'm the one who's like, you know, fighting on behalf of Iran. And like, listen, I'm just this random dude who has a YouTube channel online. I don't belong to any secret society. I don't have any power. I don't belong to any powerful faction, okay? So it's very easy to get at me, okay? And I have like three young kids. And so I need to worry about my own personal safety now, right? Because I guarantee you, like, you know, I'm in Beijing right now where people don't really know me. But if I were to step on the streets of New York City or anywhere in Canada or Europe, I'm pretty sure I would get punched in the face. People are really, really angry right now at me. And I can feel the hate in the virtual online. That's number two. And number three is, given that I'm interested in intellectual speculation, I think the next step for me is to write a book, to really bring my ideas onto the page so I can look at it closely and refine it and really bring it out to market. And like, you know, like doing this series on game theory, there's so much demand for this, right? There's so much demand for like, tell us the theories, tell us what's really going on. Give us a theoretical framework for how we ourselves can develop a better understanding of the world. So what I'll probably do is stop teaching. I've sent in my resignation to the school. So I said I will leave March, at the end of March, and finish my classes and stop my YouTube channel because I need to work on my book. I need to basically lie low. Otherwise, I mean, people say this, but it's almost like at the beginning of COVID, remember how in China, like there was already these lockdowns happening, but in the West, people were like, it's so far away. We won't be affected. And then boom, the entire world is shut down and the entire world has changed overnight. And it's in a similar situation. And then people are going to be angry. And do I really want to be a target for people? Okay, because at the end of the day, you know, I'm not like a YouTube celebrity. I don't see myself as a YouTube celebrity. I mean, I am an intellectual. I mean, I like to write books. I like to write. I'm an introvert. I don't like the publicity. I was told that if I were to go to the United States right now, I could do like a multi-city speaking tour and every seat would be filled out and I can make a lot of money for myself. I'm like, I don't want that crap. You know, I don't want to be in the middle of a firestorm. That's why I can't really sleep. And that's why it's been a very hard week for me.
Yeah. Well, I would say, Professor, from whatever it's worth for me, that there is a light in you that's shining bright and many people are inspired by that. And unfortunately in this world, those are the voices that get, you know, outshone by the loud and hateful few that, you know, want to make themselves known. So I encourage you to write a book, and I think that's a great way to take a next step in your path. And I look forward to it. And I hope that when you do write that book, you join us again on the podcast, Kurt's podcast as well, and tell us about what you've written. But yeah, that's exciting stuff. And I really do, as a, you know, stoner optimist over here, for whatever it's worth, I don't think that you should be as worried as you are. But hey, what do I know? But I do wish you the best in your endeavors, and I hope that you and your family stay safe, because what you've done is again, it's put yourself at a risk by sharing the truth, because the truth is dangerous. So, I mean, to you, I my heart goes out to you, and I wish you the best of luck in that. But with that, any final thoughts or final words as we conclude this show?
No, it's been great. Thank you.
Thank you. And I hope, you know, if you do decide to do other shows, that you'll join us again, especially when your book comes out. But until then, thank you all for tuning in. Support the professor while his channel is still up, Predictive History, on YouTube, and be on the lookout for a book coming in the near future. Until then, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. We'll be right back.
30s make you feel older than you are? You're out here trying to have a hot girl summer at 35. You're on dating apps. You're saying yes to spontaneous trips. Maybe you're rediscovering your flexibility, and your knees are like, actually, we'd like to quit. The IncrediWear Infrared Knee Sleeve uses fabric tech designed to increase blood flow and help reduce pain and speed recovery, so your knees can actually keep up with your life. It's like giving your body the support it already wants while it heals, just without all the extra pain and drama. Wear it to the gym. Wear it on a date. Wear it while you're doing things I cannot say on this podcast. It's comfortable, breathable, and works 24/7. Go to freesocks.com and grab the IncrediWear knee sleeve and a free pair of socks with purchase. That's freesox.com. Because if something's gonna give out, let it be him, not your knees.